Hello, welcome to The REPL, a podcast diving into Clojure programs and libraries. This week, I'm talking about building a text editor in ClojureScript with Nate Hunsaker, my colleague at Whimsical. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to finally record one of our conversations. So can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Whimsical?
So I have been working in Clojure for about 4 years. And started at Whimsical. I work mostly in ClojureScript on the front end. And so what that means at a company like Whimsical is writing a lot of code to render flowcharts, mind maps, diagrams, and also to work on our text editor, which is an in-house text editor that we built almost from the ground up in Clojure and ClojureScript.
Nice. And a text editor, like, there's probably many things that come to mind when people think of a text editor, like we didn't build like Vim. What does it mean to like build a text editor in a browser? Like what is the components that go into that?
Yeah, so it really is a very specific thing because we get a lot of stuff for free in the browser, but it's not really for free. It really does come at a cost, which is that we have to work with the tools at our disposal in the browser or invent them for ourselves. And inventing them is really hard. So we've done that in a few cases. And over the years, we've started and we've invented some stuff. We've learned, we've simplified, realized we didn't have to invent things. But it's definitely been a real process getting there to a good text editor in the browser setting. But to really answer your question, there's a handful of parts, I think, that are important when building a text editor in the browser. Certainly the ones that we think are important for our editor are the input collection process. So how do we get user inputs? How do we record them? And how do we turn that into data that we persist and we distribute to other users? Because this is a collaborative text editor. So a big portion of the editor is just figuring out what a user was trying to do whenever they typed keys and then persisting that and distributing that to other players, I guess, in our multiplayer experience, and make it easy for them to type with each other without stepping on each other's toes. So the other part of that that's really important is selection. And so selection is a really interesting one because ultimately we're rendering HTML. We have a DOM-based renderer. What that means is that we have to figure out a way to select text. We've gone through a couple of different iterations of this, but ultimately, what it means is that we have our own idea of what selection is. We map that to the DOM so that we can actually select text. And then we also map that in a multiplayer environment so that we can measure the text where another user is selecting and communicate that to a user as they're working with someone else in a document. And so that kind of brings me to the final part that is really critical, which is rendering. So we have to render this text editor. You know, sometimes we have to render 30,000 words, things like that. So the pipeline to take text and render it and keep that fast, especially when we're doing things like measuring text, which can be a pretty slow thing comparably in the browser, that's a big part of this too, is both like the rendering process and then the measurement step after we render to make sure that whenever we show things like context menus and cursors and things like that, that they appear in the correct spot. I guess I should say on top of that, we also have a plugin API, which is a way for us to extend this so that we can keep a pretty core set. I say core, it's still quite a large code base, but we do have different use cases for our text editor across the app. And as we've introduced it across the app in lots of different places, there are just differences in what we need, right? So whenever we're rendering text for a flowchart shape, that has a lot of different requirements to like typing a comment or typing a full document. And so, that's certainly another piece of this too, is figuring out how to reduce down the editor itself to its essential core so that we can customize it depending on what we need or customize it in ways to explore new ideas.
Nice. And so what were we previously using for text editing? This was well before I joined that all of this text editor work happened. So what did we use before and why do we need to switch?
Yeah, so we first started thinking about building a text editor at the end of 2019. And for a long time, we actually still use this editor in various parts of our app, but we were using Slate. Slate is a pretty popular text editor. It really is a fantastic editor in a lot of ways. Fantastic plugin API. And it was serving our needs pretty well for our boards product. But it did have a few issues, and that may have just been specific to how we needed to use it. But what we were finding is that we were having a really hard time with like multilingual input. So not just like Latin characters, but like trying to compose text. And by composing text, I mean entering content in Japanese or Chinese or Korean, where actually inputting characters is a lot more involved. Because in a lot of the cases, you're taking a US or a like an English layout keyboard, you're typing phonetically, and you're turning that into like compound characters that you replace and enter into the editor. So, and this isn't just for US keyboards, this is for all sorts of different keyboards. I guess there's really no simple way to put it, but there's just a lot of ways that you can input text, and not all of those were supported in the way that we were happy with. And so that was one reason why we were looking to make a change with our text editor. But, you know, looking towards the future, we knew that we wanted to build a docs product, and we knew that collaborative text editing was going to be a really important part of that. And we also knew that we had some pretty specific opinions that we wanted to have about our text editor and the way that text editing worked, certainly within the context of how we synchronize data and how we do collaboration from a technical standpoint. And so a lot of these reasons started to stack up, and it became pretty clear that there were a lot of benefits separate from, you know, the massive amount of work involved. There were a lot of benefits to building our own text editor by the time you looked at the overall user experience that we wanted to create and the amount of control that we would need for that.
And another thing people may be more familiar with is the content editable tag. And what is deficient in content editable? Why couldn't we just have plopped one of those in our app and called it a day?
Because you can't just do that. It's complicated. It's complicated for a lot of reasons. Like, so at the very simplest level, like what happens if you are using the native browser APIs and they don't work in the way that you expect? So an example of that is with collaborative text editing. So if I am typing into the same text area that you are, and I make the entire paragraph bold, well, so what we've done is we've added a bold HTML tag around all of the text. And that means that if my cursor was inside of that paragraph, it's going to reset to the beginning of the paragraph, or it could do all sorts of different things. There's a whole bunch of different ways that various JavaScript frameworks handle this. React tries pretty hard to do the right thing if you're using React for rendering. But ultimately, it's got to figure out how to make the connection that the new HTML that you submitted, like wherever your cursor was, like you need to figure out a way to get back to that specific cursor, right? And so like now you're asking it, like, I know that this text is like now, I don't know, maybe 5 levels deep in some HTML, but you're just going to get that right. And that's a lot to ask. What we found with content editable over the course of 4 years is that it is a really good device for input collection. It gives us this great API where we can get things like when the user has requested to format text as bold or enter a paragraph. There is a pretty great level of resolution for the kinds of input events that we get from content editable. But whenever you actually get into the implementation details of like keeping the cursor in the correct position as text updates, I mean, the very like simple fact that content editable doesn't work like super well with React unless you like put a lot of work into it to make that possible. It's really a huge challenge just to rely on content editable alone.
Great. So should we talk a little bit more about input collection in more detail, and like how do we collect input? What does that look like? Well, how does that feel like to the user? And then what is actually happening underneath the covers?
Yeah. So the solution that we came up with is to have a pretty strong isolation between input collection and rendering. So what that means is that whenever a user inputs characters or types a keyboard shortcut or something like that, like kind of the default mode is that nothing happens. So nothing happens unless we act on it. And that's the compromise that we've made with content editable to allow it to give us all the nice benefits that it has, without letting it go off and do its own thing in a way that causes chaos. So I should say that our approach to this is really heavily informed by the original solution that we came up with for input collection, which was that we rendered all content completely statically using React, and then we had a floating text area that would appear exactly where the cursor was. And what that allowed us to do was to collect user input for the user and like process it and then update the page behind the cursor. So this worked really well, and we specifically did this approach because it solved a lot of issues with international input. So we were specifically trying to fix the problem of you are in a collaborative editing setting and you are in the middle of composing some Japanese. And so by composing, I mean that you have typed in the phonetic alphabet in Japanese. And in Japanese, whenever you're typing, you're presented with a menu where you can take that phonetic input and turn it into kanji. That's like a text transformation process. That's like how you enter characters in Japanese. But then we were also seeing this in other ways too. Like if you hold down a vowel in like on a Mac, you'll see something called like the diacritic menu. And what that allows you to do is to take like an A or an E, add diacritics or like accent marks onto it. So there's this secondary step where there is state that the browser is tracking to give you the opportunity to decide how you actually want to insert a character. And what we found was that if you just touch any of the HTML around that text while you're doing that, all of that state, it just is discarded. Or the browser tries to keep it. It tries really hard to keep it. And that can be problematic in its own ways too. So for us, having a strong separation between the actual input that's collected and how it's output to the screen has been really essential for us to maintain a good user experience. And so we started out with a floating text area that moved around with you. And over time, we've replaced that by making just all of our content use content editable. But we still don't allow content editable to actually do HTML manipulation for us. Like ultimately, we're still responsible for taking the input, figuring out where it should go under the hood in our text editor data structure, and then render new output. And so that's, I think, probably the central piece of how it works.
And so if a user, like say, types an A and holds it down, and then they get the little menu of diacritics, and they pick, you know, A with a hit on top of it, what's actually happening in the browser? Like there was an A typed, it's rendered somewhere on the screen, and then does that get like backspaced and replaced with an A with a hat on it? Or how does the browser kind of communicate to you that this thing has changed?
Yeah, I'll give you a general answer because it really does vary by browser, unfortunately. But essentially, you get a series of input events. And these input events could be key down characters and events, or it could be the before input and the input event. So the before input event, I'd say it's a newer event, certainly within the scope of web APIs, but it gives you the opportunity to intercept input before it is inserted into the page. So what this means is that if you have a input, like say a text input, really any kind of thing where you're collecting input from a user, you're going to get a before input event that fires before the actual input is processed. And this is a really fantastic API because it gives us a couple of things that we need. The first is it gets us the type of the input. So is it like a insert text event? Is it a insert replacement text event type? For example, if you're on iOS and like the text autocorrects because the browser decides it is incorrect text. So it's going to give you that information to give you the context to know what the user actually is trying to do. Or certainly at least what the browser thinks the user is trying to do. And on top of that, it gives you the data that was actually input with the event. So if you're typing like hello world, you're getting all those individual characters are coming through as insert text events. So you're getting one for the H. You'll see an insert text with an H character with it. And then you're getting one final crucial thing with that. Maybe not the final thing, but for us, a crucial thing, which is that you're getting the target range. So what this actually tells you is where in the DOM this selection is, like this text is actually going to be inserted. So for autocomplete, for example, you'll get an event that says like, hey, we're trying to insert this replacement text. This is the text that we want to replace, and this is the range in the DOM that we want to replace it with. And so whenever we take that event, what we can do then is we can take the native DOM event information, translate that to the relevant areas like the relevant selection range and the relevant character content for our text editor as data. And then we transform the editor. I should say first, we stop the event from happening most of the time. So the input isn't going to process and the browser isn't going to immediately modify that HTML. And then we take those actions, we transform our editor data structure, and then that kicks off a huge chain of events to update the component structure in our React renderer to update the page with the new content.
Right. Some of the places where this happens were surprising to me, even things as simple as on iOS, like when you press spacebar twice and it puts a full stop in. Like at one point, we weren't supporting that at all, or even setting the capitalization after a full stop. So there's all of these kind of bespoke, strange input environments and things that we could never hard code or re-implement ourselves from scratch. Or, you know, just be a monumental task to do that all ourselves, which I guess is why we switched from that floating text input into the whole page being a content editable text area.
Yeah, that's precisely right. We fought that for a while. I think we gave a pretty valiant effort and tried. And I think that there was just a cost to our design, which over time became hard to overcome. So the autocomplete is a perfect example of that, where you would type space twice. And if your cursor is on this floating text input, it doesn't have that context. It doesn't know. We could fill it with the right content so that it could try to make the suggestion. But ultimately, it just doesn't know. And this also comes up too with like whenever you're on iOS and you hold down the space bar to move the cursor around, the cursor has to know that it can like traverse the text. And if it doesn't look like it can process input, Safari is just going to say like the cursor isn't allowed to go here. I think we knew user input was complicated. We just didn't know the extent of all of the different behaviors and the trickiness and sort of like, but over time we sort of started to thread it correctly and figure out like what the actual correct implementation was. And that's what led us to content editable, which has been a pretty tremendous challenge to work towards, but it's allowed us to do a lot of that stuff and support a lot of those user input events.
Right. So moving on to the next part of text editor selection, tell me more about what does it mean to select? Like you talked about this iOS, hold down the space bar. Like we have our own selection cursor, but then there's the browser cursor and like we're sort of trying to impose our own stuff on top of it, but also accept the browser stuff. How does that all mix together?
Yeah, it has become pretty straightforward, I would say. Ultimately, what we're doing is we need to maintain our own sense of the cursor. And we need to do that specifically for the reason I mentioned before. Like if we just have DOM selection and the HTML changes in a way that the browser can't translate, the cursor selection is lost or it like resets to the start of the input, and that's really bad. So we maintain our own sense of selection. And what that means is that we have a selection API purely in code that we use to navigate the text editor to select pieces of it for things like copy paste. So like if you copy an area of text in the editor, it's not copying, you know, that HTML on the page. It's looking to see we're at this point in the document, we're at this other point in the document, copy all the text as data in there and convert it into whatever format that we need. So we ultimately need to synchronize it back to native DOM selection. And that's important for a whole host of reasons. The primary one being mobile support. So it's pretty hard to do synthetic selection without some sort of native element if you're trying to support mobile phones, just because there's a lot of text selection patterns and affordances that need to work correctly. And having solid support for native DOM selection is the basis of that. So the solution that we've arrived at is to synchronize our selection with native selection. And from there, once we've established the correct native selection, we use a combination of the input events that I mentioned before and the target ranges for those input events to inform like the new selection areas, as well as the like key events that happen in the DOM, especially on mobile phones. So what I'm talking about here is whenever you've like long pressed on iOS, you've got the handlebars and you're moving those around. We can listen to events to know when that selection has changed and map that back to our editor. And then in terms of actually like measuring text and showing our synthetic cursor, which I should say we show our own synthetic cursor, and that's to add additional hints to know if you're typing in bold text or italics text. So we have this nice behavior where if you push Command I, it or Control I, it engages italics text formatting. And when that happens, your cursor slants about 30 degrees. And whenever you're inside of bold text or you engage bold text, it becomes a little bit thicker. And as you're zooming in and out of a board, we found that there's actually some really nice specific patterns for making the cursor look nice and easy to see as you've like zoomed in really high into large text or like zoomed all the way out to really tiny text. So we can do that because we have put the cursor into the correct position in the DOM, and then we can measure that. So we've got this pipeline that goes from making sure that the native selection is correct, and then we apply our synthetic operations on top of that.
So with the native selection, normally when you do a native selection in the browser, it draws like sort of a light blue box, or I don't quite know what you'd call it, but there's a visual indication from the browser that you've done a native selection. But we have our own other styling. So are we canceling out, like preventing the, you know, using CSS or something to prevent the browser's native styling to show up for selection, or do they mix together, or am I?
Yeah, that's right. So there's a couple of places where we show the native cursor. For the most part, we hide it. But whenever we're composing text, so you're using like the Japanese input menu or the Chinese input menu, we show the native cursor for that so that we can always make sure to show the native UI where it really matters. On iOS and Android, we show the native cursor as well because it has a lot of those nice affordances. So whenever you're dragging around by holding down the space bar on an iOS device, or you are selecting text and you're moving those handles around, we want to be sure to show that because it's really vital. But for desktop, we move a synthetic cursor around to follow the user wherever they're going. And then, yeah, that's where we add those visual hints. So there's a combination of them. Longer term, I'm kind of curious about what our options are to change the native cursor, to update the presentation of that. Like, can we update the cursor icon itself to slant it and things like that? But to get the level of control over the visual presentation that we want, we've sort of resorted to this to show a synthetic cursor that floats around and follows you around wherever the cursor is in the DOM.
Yeah. One other part of selection, at least in my mind, is like word boundary movement. So when you do like option left and right, it moves by a word, or option up and down does like by paragraph and so on. So how did we, I don't think we got any of that for free, did we, with the browser?
No, we certainly didn't. Yeah. So that is like, we have a whole series of APIs for that that can skip through our content and jump word by word, line by line, things like that. There's some specific behaviors across browsers, some of them that we maintain, some of them that we keep consistent across the board. There's a lot of expectations around how that should work from the Cocoa APIs for Mac, and like how that should work on Android and things like that. So that has been a real challenge to keep up. I think as we lean harder into content editable, it'll be really curious to see how we can rely more on the native operations. But we still need that code in a lot of cases whenever we're doing specific text transformations. So for example, it is nice to be able to move forward by a word or move to the end of a line in pure code. And so ultimately we still need some of that to be able to make the cursor movements that we want to make.
And then that moves us to the last stage, which is rendering. And I just want to highlight something in case people were wondering about this. Like, we are intercepting all of the browser's input events. Like, normally you would type a key and the browser would like render that key in the text area immediately as it responds to it. But we are preventing that and running ClojureScript code. And that all needs to, I guess, run in time to then go back and update the browser. It appears to the user as if they type the character like any other site on the internet, but you know, we had quite a bit of code that had to run in between the key press and the rendering. So tell me a little bit about, like, I guess, rendering overall, and then like how we managed to make that performant and run at least 60 frames per second.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. We use React for rendering, and we're using a pretty standard like reagent and reframe style setup. So we've got a bunch of layers on top of Reframe that we've built for ourselves, but ultimately it's all Radoms under the hood and trees of dependencies. And we obviously can't render every single paragraph every time text updates, right? So we have developed a series of functions and data subscriptions that break down the editor into pieces so that we can mitigate as much render updates as possible. And I think that that has been a challenge for us, especially with the frameworks that we use to orchestrate all of the different timelines of updates at the same time. So we've got React rendering, we've got the Reframe scheduler, we've got the Reagent scheduler. All of that stuff mostly works pretty well together, but especially when you're dealing with user input and the tolerance is pretty low for making sure things happen in a specific sequence of events, it can be really tough to get that right. And I think that's been a key challenge for us.
Yeah. So tell me more about, like, what does it mean to render text? And then we have some particular interesting challenges with rendering text that perhaps most people wouldn't face.
Yeah. So I think one big challenge is just taking our editor content as pure data and turning it into something that can be rendered as a DOM tree, like as an HTML tree. So if we have different ranges of formatting that all step over each other in ways that a tree can't describe, we have to figure out how to turn that into something that can be converted into a DOM tree. So what that means is that we go through a series of steps where we take all of the content in our editor, we group it into logical chunks, do some post-processing on it to make sure that things like links don't nest inside of each other, which is both a bad user experience, but also some browsers just can't do that, or they won't. It is funny, like, you oftentimes, like, you want to use the best HTML you can, and sometimes you can't because you just can't put a div inside of a button and things like that.
So what's an example of overlapping text formatting? When would this come into play?
Yeah, I think where this especially comes into play is with links. I think links are a really good example of this, where say you've got a link and part of it is formatted bold and part of it isn't. We can't turn that into two separate links. We can't have the link that isn't bold and the link that is bold, right? You've got like this link to a URL and maybe someone's added, I don't know, a bold tag or something for emphasis, or maybe they've added a comment to it and they didn't quite get all of the link. It can't create two discrete links. That's just weird. So you do have to make some decisions about that, right? So like if we have a link and we have the formatting for a comment range to say like someone wants to edit and they've added a comment to say like, hey, I think you should say it, you know, this way or that way. We have to figure out the order of priority in which we nest those tags because they have to get inserted into the DOM in a way that doesn't feel weird to a user. So that's a real challenge to figure out, is like, what is the highest priority tag? Like, what is the thing that goes on top always?
So for the bold text, say you highlighted, you know, like apple.com in like some link, what would that translate to in the DOM, or how would we render that to the DOM?
Yeah. So, I mean, best case scenario is that we have the link tag on the outside and then we've got bold text inside wrapping the actual text. So you've got a pretty clean nest where the link is on the outside, the bold text is on the inside. On the weird case where say you have a link and half of it is bold and half of it isn't, there's lots of weird combinations like this. We don't have to necessarily get into all of them, but ultimately we know that we want the link tag to be continuous. Mm-hmm. Like the link tag has to maintain its structure. And so what that means is that we usually will have to do something like split the underlying bold text up into a region that sits inside of the link and then the region that sits outside of the link. And so what we've done is we've reordered the nesting and put it into a tree form such that that linear string of characters and formatting nodes and things like that that we're using as pure data turns into something that looks and expects the way that you would want.
Right. And then we have like a particularly big challenge. Well, it seems big to me, maybe not so much to you, but we use Canvas for rendering in our boards when things aren't being edited. So tell us about like the handoff between the sort of editor and non-editor rendering and how that works.
Yeah, so it is a huge challenge. We have a DOM renderer. We have arrived at that DOM renderer for text for a lot of reasons. accessibility, like composition support, user input support, all of those things have led us to use DOM as the primary rendering target for editing text. But that's not going to render for us like a flowchart shape on our board product. And we have to not only be able to render that text, but as you're typing into a flowchart shape or a text box, we have to know how big that text is to see if we need to expand the size of that shape. And we obviously don't want all shapes to expand out into like 2000 pixel wide blocks. That's, no one wants that, or maybe some people want that. But so we have to figure out how to line wrap text, which means we have to figure out, like, separate from like kind of punting on this problem and letting the browser do it, we have to figure out where those line boundaries are, so that if you've typed something and we know that the flowchart shape or the diagram is intended to be 200 pixels wide, that it wraps text in a way that both the user would expect and I think more specifically the way the browser expects it to wrap. So that's a pretty complicated problem, figuring out where the word boundaries are in the text. So to do that, we've also built a text layout engine for our Canvas product. And what it does is it takes our editor format. And, you know, before I had said that we take that stream of data in our editor and we turn it into something that the, like, the HTML render output can understand and make sense. And we have to do a similar thing for our Canvas product, where we take the text, we figure out what each individual line is, the boundaries of those lines, how tall they are based upon the content, and produce a layout that we can then use to inform the actual drawing of the flowchart shapes.
Right. So when a user is editing text, they're using the DOM editor. Everything's kind of rendering and text wrapping with browser-based APIs. Like, we set the width of the text as 200 pixels wide. But then when the user clicks away from that and stops editing, we switch to Canvas-based rendering for performance, I think, mainly. Like, we could theoretically have all of these text areas floating around in the app. It would just be extremely slow, I imagine.
It would be very slow. Yeah, that was the principal problem that we had with our editor. Sorry, not our editor, but our board renderer when we first started out, is that it was all SVG-based, which just looks fantastic, right? Like, it's SVG, the browser knows how to render it, everything looks super sharp. You can export it as an SVG. It's just like basically copying and pasting almost literally. And that works really well until you start getting above a certain size and you're dealing with like limitations of how many DOM nodes you have on the screen and like the memory footprint of that. And like, you just get to a certain count of DOM nodes and things just slow down. It's just like this base rust or tax. Yeah, so we render everything with Canvas, and we could move around all of the text, like with CSS transforms or something like that. We could get into like only showing the text that appears on screen, but that doesn't hit the performance goals that we want. And we still need to measure the text anyway. So like, we still have this problem of like, even if we did render it to DOM, I guess we could measure with the DOM measurement APIs. We could get like the bounding client rect for the text, but it still leaves a lot of difficult challenges. So the solution that we've arrived at is to build our own custom renderer, which in practice is really less of, like, calling it a custom renderer, I think, kind of makes it sound like more than it is. Really, the entire thing is all about figuring out where line boundaries are to wrap text, and then figuring out how tall those lines are. So really, the majority of it is figuring out where are we plotting lines of text so that we can show them in the correct place that's consistent with where the DOM expects them to be.
Right. So the browser has like some native text wrapping algorithm. We need to match that ideally perfectly. And then we sort of calculate like the line length and where the line breaks go. And then we just hand off the text to, I guess, the Canvas text rendering APIs to render that text into the canvas.
Yeah, that's right. It's a little bit more complicated than just giving the, like, the fill text API in Canvas our text. We've got links, we've got at mentions where you can like mention a specific file, and those have like padding around them and they like look like a pill. So we do have to break it up into a series of instructions, but fundamentally, that's, if you were to step back a bit and forget about that, I think it's mostly that. It's figuring out where the text should be and putting it in the right spot.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because when we first started the editor, we thought that we would use Canvas for everything. At the time, we didn't have a Docs product, so we were looking at this really in the context of boards for a lot of our needs. We knew that we had a Docs product coming up, but like the thing that people knew us for was our whiteboarding product, and we knew that we would need really good text editing there too. So for a while, I guess we always thought that we would get to Canvas rendering, and we've landed on the DOM rendering for a lot of other specific reasons. But I still wonder sometimes if, like, looking towards the future, I know everyone else working on the editor doesn't want to hear me say this at all. You know, sorry, everybody. But I really do wonder about that. If you were to look at like the ideal end goal for both our board renderer and our docs product, like ultimately we've got to render text to a canvas because it's got to show up, right? Like we've got a 2D graphics API, text has got to go there. If we make that as good as possible, we can start to get to the point where we can think, okay, you know, yeah, maybe we could render our docs product purely in Canvas. And we know that this isn't crazy. I mean, you know, we see products like Google Docs has decided to do this. And when you look at like some of our performance goals for very, very, very big docs, ultimately, like I said before, there's the tax to having lots of DOM nodes. So if we're looking at really big docs, a really not straightforward, but like one of the classic solutions for dealing with long lists of data is windowing, right? Where you like only actually render the parts of the list that are visible on the screen. So it looks like you've got 100,000 records, but you're just recycling through the same 10 or 15 list views or list item views as you're scrolling along. And it's like, it's all this elaborate carousel where it's moving things around to make it look like the phone or whatever you're using is juggling all this content, right? That's a really good solution for docs too, because docs are just lists of paragraphs, right? So it's a very similar solution. And I think once you get to the point where you have really good text measurement, something like that starts to become like, well, so certainly having good text measurement is the basis for having good windowing. And once our text measurement gets to the point where we can do that for boards, it'll be really interesting to see how that informs the design of our editor for long form docs too.
I should say we're on the back of a extremely long migration process away from Slate. In fact, I think we still have a little bit remaining, if I'm looking at the code base correctly.
Yeah, we've cornered it. There's one final piece and we have our sights on it. It'll be a beautiful day when that happens. I'm going to order a cake because it's, yeah. Again, Slate is a great library. Specifically for us, it ended up not being precisely what we needed for our requirements. But our version of Slate is quite old at this point, and so it would be great to just finally move to the new editor.
Yeah. I think everyone might want to take like a year or two break from major editor changes before we start talking about Canvas, but we will see.
Yeah, I think maybe I don't know if it's a character flaw or something, but I just love change. I just love it. It exhilarates me. But I think we're at a really good point where we can kind of keep, we've got these two renderers. They're improving over time. And I think I can see how in the future they would converge. For the time being, it's doing what we need it to do. And that's enough.
All right. One other thing we use that we had to invent, well, not invent, but incorporate ourselves was spell checking. So tell me, like, why couldn't we just use the browser spell check and what did we use instead?
Yeah, this is a particularly frustrating one because browser spell check is really good. It uses the user's prior settings. It knows their language, but getting access to spell checking suggestions is quite hard. And the only way that you can get access to them is through the context menu, like the right-click context menu. So well, I shouldn't say that that's true everywhere, but for like the classic case of using like Firefox or Chrome or Safari on a desktop computer, the way that you get at spell check is through the right-click context menu. And that's frustrating because we have a lot of specific things that we want to do with context menus. So we want to have the ability to select text, right-click and copy it as Markdown, for example, or right-click on an image and copy that image out, or copy a link to the specific part of a document. And so we have this need to expose those actions for our app, but that sort of takes over the context menu. So we're not talking about rendering the native context menu anymore. So what do we do if we have spell check And the only way to get the actual spell check suggestions is through the right-click context menu. Well, so on iOS and Android, we use the native spell check. We use it because the UI there is particularly good. You hover over it, your keyboard shows you the correction, and we have really good UI for that. So we don't have to worry about this so much for mobile phones. But for desktop browsers, it means that we have to figure out how to spell check, because ultimately what we're trying to do is make a dock or a board that allows our users to like make something that looks good and they have confidence in. And if we aren't spell checking or catching spell check mistakes for them, I mean, that's just the worst, right? You spend all this time on a flowchart. You're like, hey, I've like modeled our system operation processes. Like, hey, leadership team, what do you think of this? And you've like spelled the department wrong on accident. And that's not great, right? So we don't want that. So the solution we arrived at was that we actually started thinking about this on the back end. So we were thinking, okay, we know that we are synchronizing all content. So what if we had a back end process that took the changes, and changes come up from our sync process, they get submitted, and then we send down a WebSocket event or something else that says like, hey, this range is spelled incorrectly. Here are the suggestions. We started out with that in our initial discovery work just because it made sense. Like if we use a backend system, we could use something like AI spell check or grammar suggestions. We could really pick the tool that we wanted to over time and find the best tool. And what we actually landed on was just in prototyping to try to figure out how this would work. We started prototyping spell check in the browser to figure out like, yeah, like what is the actual user experience that we want? And to do that, we created a quick little example that used a WebAssembly compiled version of Hunspell just so that we could get it up and running. And it turned out like we actually really liked that solution a lot. It has a lot of advantages. For one, there isn't the extra burden on our servers. There isn't the latency of like round trip spell check. Looking towards the future, I don't know when we will be there, but we're always looking for a future where we have offline support. And so we kind of didn't like the backend approach that some tools use where you lose your network connection and you just can't spell check anymore. It just goes away. So we started experimenting with Hunspell. This was a real learning experience for us because we hadn't really worked with WebAssembly before for our app and looked at what options were available. And it turns out that the tooling is just fantastic there, where we were able to use mscriptum to compile a version of Hunspell with WebAssembly. And it's great because then you download it as a separate binary. It works. And then like you have all of your dictionaries. It's easy to modify those dictionaries. Relatively straightforward to say like, hey, this word isn't supported. Let's just add this word. And so I think that it's worked pretty well for us. You know, ultimately it's Hunspell as a tool. Hunspell is a specific type of spell checker, you know? So I know there's like the AI based or machine learning based, I should say, spell checking that can kind of guess to see like, is this word that I've never come up with probably spelled correctly? And I think it would be nice to have some of that, but in practice, just having people be able to add their own dictionary words and to be able to on the fly do some nice things like say, we know that this name is definitely spelled correctly because this is a member of the workspace, has been really cool for us. So that's where we go. And then back to the word navigation and the word boundary stuff, a lot of the spell check wraps up into that, where having rich APIs for figuring out where all the word boundaries are in our code translates into finding all of the specific words that have changed since the last update so that we don't have to have spell check run on like the entire document. It can really only just run on the specific parts that have changed.
Nice. That would be quite a big performance win on large documents.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me about Grammarly support, because I know it's something we'd like to get to. I don't think it's quite there yet, but what do we need to do to get Grammarly support and why is that tricky?
Yeah, it's a little tricky. So the tricky thing about that is that Grammarly is kind of like another user inserting characters on behalf of the person using Grammarly. And that has really required us to take the work that we had done to move to content editable to the next level. So the work that we're doing to support Grammarly really does involve making sure that we have set up the page correctly so that whenever Grammarly inserts suggestion, it gives us all of the information that we need to make that change. And so we don't support Grammarly right now, but the way that we're planning to do it, you know, this work is in progress now, is to just add more information to the HTML so that we have higher resolution information about where an input event happened, what the range was, and so that whenever an input event comes in, we can treat it just like any other user input. And I think it's been pretty cool to see, because really the trend that we're moving towards is being able to process input that we don't expect in new ways, which just has all sorts of like very real benefits in other areas. So as we have improved our composition and our Grammarly support, we have seen major improvements in our mobile support and support for things that we just totally didn't expect, and they just work. Because fundamentally what we're doing is we're making the editor a better input collection device for all sorts of input. And so giving the HTML the information and the hooks that it needs is allowing us to move closer to having full Grammarly support, which can be a real challenge because there's no standards for these things. It's just like Grammarly is doing Grammarly's thing and we're trying our hardest. Like, we just need to do a few things so that we can talk together a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a lot about like all of the things we've had to do to make this text editor, but what are some of the payoffs, like the things that we now get to do that are really nice because we have our own custom text editor?
Yeah. So I think the level of control really is one of the big things. So as we have changed their idea of what the product is over time and what the product can do, having the ability to customize different pieces of it has been really essential. So going back to the board's text editing stuff, being able to make changes to the editor to support the ability to both render to Canvas and DOM has, like, it's required us to change some core pieces of the editor. There are a lot of cases where we go in and we see that like a specific composition change isn't working the way that we expect. So by this, I'm talking specifically about, we have a large contingent of coworkers from Latvia at our company. And like typing diacritics in Latvian, sometimes it just does weird stuff. And we're able to go in and fix it. In a lot of cases, we go in and we try to fix it. And one of our first things to do is we say, okay, actually, let's go and let's see what this other tool is doing to see if they've encountered this problem before. And those tools have the same problem. And so it's
kind of satisfying, right?
You know, it's so funny whenever we would have issues with undo, redo, or bold text and things like that. And then we go and we're like messaging each other in Slack. And then we see that Slack has that same issue. And we're like, great, what do we do now? It is satisfying because I think it doesn't quite feel real that what you're building is going to help you with those things until you hit situations like that where you remember like, oh yeah, like if we had used a third-party library for this, you know, maybe we would have forked the library and we would have like spent some time trying to understand how the library works to make the change. And then do we maintain our fork over time if the change isn't merged in? What if the change is antithetical to like the philosophy of the framework? I don't mean to sound philosophical about that, but like if we make a change to a plugin API that the original author doesn't agree with, what is that process like to actually reconcile those changes? And so it's hard. I think if any of us were to answer whether or not we wanted to take the time to build the editor versus work on other features in Whimsical, I think it would still be a really hard thing to grapple with. In doing it, we really have been able to just like completely control all of this and fix these issues. That has allowed us to build a really great editor.
Do you want to estimate how many engineer years we've spent?
No. I can say we do have a small team. And a lot of the decisions that we've made in the editor are to ensure that we can continue to work on it as a small team. At least, certainly, if you look historically, we have not had 100 engineers working on this editor. We've had somewhere between 2 to 6 engineers working on the editor at various stages of its development. So I can say, like, getting us to the initial release of our docs product, which was the first use case for our new editor, I guess it was about a year and change. So it was a combination of like the technical development of the text editor plus a couple of iterations on the initial product idea. And then over the course of, well, since about, I guess, the end of 2020 on from till now, it's slowly found its way into the other surface areas of the app. So it's showed up in our comments feature across the app. It's shown up in our boards product across all the different shapes. And so it's not, to say it's just boards doesn't really do justice to the team that did the migration, because we have a whole wireframing feature and we have a whole mind mapping feature and flowcharts and all sorts of stuff. And so, yeah, it has been a lot of work. I couldn't tell you how many man hours it has been, but it certainly has been the longest running project at the company, for sure.
It's going to be a good day when we finally remove Slate from our package.json.
Yeah, that'll be a fun day.
So we've sort of touched on sync and multiplayer a little bit, but can you explain a bit more, like, how do we do multiplayer sync and what does that look like? Well, I guess they're really two things in our case. So can you explain, you know, the difference between the two and, yeah, how they work?
Yeah, so we have two types of multiplayer. We have the change management APIs. So whenever you enter text or you change the name of a file, for example, we have a sync process that takes those changes and reconciles them in the backend and sends out those updates to other users. So let's say I type text, I send it up as a change. It checks to see if, you know, you've typed text first, and if so, it sends your changes down. I will update my local copy, reapply those changes, and submit them up again. So you could say that we have a way of reconciling those conflicts and making it so that as users change information, they get reliably merged together in a way that we can predict. So that is how we propagate updates. So what that means is, like, if I change a paragraph of text, that means that's how you're going to get it, is the server is going to have its idea of what the version of the file is, and it makes sure that everyone that is in that file or that is watching that file, whenever they open it up, gets those updates. So that is a slower process, but by slow, I mean that it's not slow necessarily. It's just it's able to operate with a high level of latency.
It's batched as well.
Yeah, that's right. And so the idea there is, yeah, like say you're offline, you make some changes, your changes in your version of it still apply. And then whenever you reconnect it, theoretically, it pulls down the, not theoretically, but conceptually, I guess it should be able to recover from that because it can replay those changes and reconcile them with the backend in a reliable way. And that's all using like closure data structures to handle that. So maps, sets, vectors, things like that. Then there is the other piece, which is our real-time APIs for actually sending high-frequency updates immediately so that we have a good multiplayer experience. So that means mouse cursors, selection, like moving content around on the screen really quickly so that if someone is in the middle of dragging something, another user knows that they're touching that object. And that uses a different set of real-time APIs using, oh shoot, the name escapes me.
WebSockets?
It's using WebSockets, and then it's using, I think we've gone back and forth through different implementations of this, and we've gone back and forth with WebRTC too. But basically, we have a solution for quickly sending updates across multiple users so that if I've selected text, that's not going through our traditional sync model. We're not syncing and persisting your user selection. That is something that is local to your client and that we dispatch as a visual update to other users' devices. So like this API does not actually, like there is no actual text collaboration or like change happening. It's just hints to know what the other user is doing.
Do you think we could add that? Like how difficult would that be to have like two sources of text, real-time, character by character, and then sync in a chunk?
It's really something that I've wondered about because the way that we store content for our text editor, for Docs, the product, to get that really high resolution collaboration, it is a relatively large format. And so we pay for that in storage. And so it is a really interesting idea. So like if we were to do something like taking from like the Erling example, if we had like a long running process in the back end that was responsible for maintaining the text editing session, and then all users submitted events to update that, and then it was persisted in the back end. There's a lot of different ways that you could do it. Also, I think it's really interesting to see what other apps are doing with local first solutions, where there's like your local version of your data, and like you have it. If you want to change it, you have to communicate with other clients. I think there's a lot of really interesting ideas there. Fundamentally, I think what we've settled on is that if you want to get 100 people into a file editing content, like having a single source of truth that you can reliably depend on is really valuable. And so I think that that's why we haven't explored that. But I think also we just haven't felt the need to.
Right. So let's say someone is in our position in 2023. They're saying, hey, I want to do, hopefully they're not going to compete with Whimsical, but you know, they're going to create something that needs, you know, more control than just sort of stock standard browser stuff. Like, what would you do if we were here today in 2023, starting from scratch? Would you go on this journey again? Would you do something different?
So I think the key change that's happened in the past 4 years is that the support for the before input event, that input event that gives you much more control to process user input, I think support for that and the general chaos of content editable has died down. If I were to look into this again, I would probably take a pretty sharp look at Lexical, the text editor. I think it is doing a lot of things right. I am a little bit envious of it for its ability to, like, it has its own text renderer for text updates that doesn't use React, at least last I checked. And I feel that trying to delicately balance content editable with React is not fun. I think Lexical is doing that really well, and that's coming out of prior experience with things like DraftJS, I believe, and others. It is a fantastic tool for building text editors, and I would probably look there first.
Right. And Lexical is kind of a skeleton of a text editor?
Yep, that's right. Actually, stepping back a little bit too, I think if you're really building a collaborative text editor, you've got to step back and look at how you're storing content, what languages you're using, what the collaborative text editing experience looks like, and then figure out how you're going to store that text and what that looks like to interact with a tool. And I think that that's really it, is like you've got to figure out how you're going to store this data first and manage it and your goals with it. And if you're dropping JSON into a Postgres column, that is different than if you're trying to do something else with a little bit more flexibility. It really depends on your use case. For us, having everything in Clojure all the way up and down is really valuable, especially once we start getting into things like being able to process text on the back end with a lot of common functionality with the front end. That is really cool, and it's awesome to be able to do that. But I think the cost of learning what we've learned has been quite high, and I would certainly prototype with something like Lexical first to get a feel for if it's going to fit what you need.
Great. Well, if anyone is interested in working at Whimsical, I don't think we are hiring as of today, but definitely keep an eye on our careers page, because you too could be deep in the bowels of text editing one day if you work with us. Yeah. So thanks, Nate, for coming on and sharing a bit about text editing, and I am looking forward to the slate day. Maybe we can have like a company holiday, like every year.
Ooh, we definitely should.
Okay.
I'm all for holidays.
Okay.
I think that sounds great.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks.